everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you, and with me, as always, is Brandon Odo.
You.
Well, we're continuing our, we've been doing this sort of unofficial series that I guess we should probably just make official on who are the people in your neighborhood, essentially. What are the other people in the hospital, maybe that we interact with on a daily basis, but don't really know much about and understand? We've talked to a couple of different folks that we see and interact with in the ICU on a regular basis. And today we've got another guest to sort of help us out with a role that likely most of us know exists. We probably interact with them pretty regularly, but may really know next to nothing about what they really do and are about, and that's chaplains. I think we can all agree that the chaplains in the hospital can be an indispensable part of the critical care team, helping to care for our patients, but we really maybe don't understand what they do. So we're joined today by the Reverend Christine Davies. She runs the chaplaincy department at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital. She's an ordained Presbyterian minister, an educator, and a certified chaplain in clinical pastoral education. And she's going to join us today and discuss a little bit about what chaplains do and kind of what that role is all about. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited for our conversation to illuminate your listeners on what on earth a chaplain does.
Yeah, well, we're all about illumination. So why don't we start there? I mean, what is a hospital chaplain? What is this role? I mean, we know what a nurse does. We know what a respiratory therapist does. What is a chaplain in the hospital setting? Of course, it may mean something else in other environments. And what do they do?
Absolutely. So I will start off by saying what it takes to become a hospital chaplain, and then maybe I'll go into that a little bit more about what our daily life looks like, because I think there's a big misconception in general about what chaplains are. Sometimes people think, it's just a clergy person that has wandered in off the street, or sometimes in my office, I'll even get calls from someone saying, oh, I want to come and pray with patients. And I say, no, that's not what we do. We have a lot more training than that. And I joke, I wouldn't call up neurosurgery and be like, yes, I'd like to operate today. This is a profession and a field. So in order to be a healthcare chaplain, one needs to have an advanced degree in theology or divinity, some sort of, it's usually a 3-year master degree. On top of that, they have to do 1,600 hours of postgraduate training as an intern, as a resident, and actually part of what I do in my role is I run those training programs. And then someone has to have their own ordination or endorsement, so they have to be grounded in their own faith tradition. That's why I'm a Presbyterian minister, but we have to know enough, and a lot of our training is about becoming familiar with people in all faith traditions or no faith tradition to really meet people wherever they are. And a lot of what I do in my hospital is more reactive and responsive than proactive, but it varies hospital by hospital. We are a member of the clinical care team. We are charting. We are responding to consults. In my hospital, I'm at a level 1 trauma center. So a lot of what we're doing is responding to all of the traumas that come in as a member of the trauma team. Same thing with the codes throughout the hospital. Because you can imagine if you get a call that your loved one's been in a car accident, you're going to arrive to the hospital and you are going to be very anxious, very worried, very scared about what's going on. So we arrive as the person to be the family support. We are the liaison with the medical team to get answers because you all need to be doing what you're doing in the trauma bay, but the family needs an additional layer of support. And then, if the situation does not go well and the patient cannot, be revived or saved, then we're already embedded in that situation to do that bereavement support. The bulk of what we do is bereavement support. Probably 80% of the work that we get called for is around end of life, particularly in the ICU. We're often involved in family meetings, in goals of care setting, in talking with the families and helping them to understand who their loved one is and what their loved one might want. And then when the time of death is there, we are often doing ritual around that. So if if the family does want a prayer, if the family needs help saying goodbye, we're facilitating that. We're there as a presence to witness what is going on and help people to not feel alone in that. And then in other areas of the hospital, we sometimes make routine visits or make consults. I like to define us as an extra layer of emotional and spiritual support. So I always encourage care team members to put in a consult because in my perfect world, that we would have enough chaplains so that every patient could get a visit. We don't have that many, so we really rely on staff to identify what spiritual distress might look like, and we can go into that in order to help us to be able to meet with people, because hospitalizations bring up all sorts of emotions and spiritual concerns for people, even if they are not critically ill or at end of life. I was just talking with someone the other day who was there for something very routine, really just getting observed, but they were upset because the last time they were in a hospital, they were saying goodbye to their mother. And so all of that kind of comes flooding back. So we're really addressing the holistic emotions and spirituality of all of our patients. And then we're also there for family, as I mentioned before. And I think we're the only discipline in the hospital that is serving patients, family, and staff. We do a lot of staff support. Sometimes that is in informal ways, checking in with the providers after there's been a death or a really unfortunate incident. Sometimes we're doing more formalized debriefing or other supportive measures for the hospital staff.
So you must start with prior training in some sort of religious faith, and then there's this additional kind of clinical training, and then there's a some certification or something mm-hmm. that's offered for yes. this. Where is this kind of training done? Is it just like through universities?
We are accredited with the Department of Education, actually through our hospital. So our my hospital is a site where someone can go for that 1,600-hour postgraduate training. They get certificates in that. So it's called Clinical Pastoral Education, in case anyone's really interested in it. And there's a whole organization. And so I am a clinical pastoral education supervisor or certified educator.
So a chaplain, is this pretty standard? Like in pretty much any hospital across this country, this would be their background? Or is it yes. not as consistent?
Hopefully. Yeah. Some hospitals don't have chaplains at all. That is something that, we're really trying to advocate for the inclusion of chaplains. There are some smaller hospitals out there, sometimes more rural hospitals, where they aren't utilizing chaplains to the way that they could. We're not a billable service. So sometimes, we are seen as a nice to have, but not mandatory. However, that also depends on how you read the Joint Commission regulations and how you interpret them, because you are supposed to provide for patients' spiritual needs and to do a spiritual assessment on patients. So I'm a big advocate that we are important, but there are, my best advice is to check in with your spiritual care departments wherever you are currently working and inquire about what they have available and how you might partner with them.
I feel like one of the confusions that a lot of clinicians have is, to what extent is a chaplain service religious? In other words, I think we don't really know how to apply a service that, even if it has some things that seem clearly beneficial, like being of support to patients and family, but we don't really know what to do with a person whose role is at least in part a religious one, at least as we perceive it, especially if maybe that's not the faith of this particular patient, or maybe they don't have any at all. It's just not a religious person.
Yep, I think that's a common question. So in our line, there's kind of religious care, I would say maybe like a circle, and spiritual care, maybe like a Venn diagram. And so the religious care we can arrange for a patient if they would like. So for instance, we have in my hospital, we have a lot of Catholic patients that want a priest to be there to do what is called sacrament of the sick or anointing, what people used to refer to as last rites. So people sometimes want the priest for that reason. Or if we have Jewish patients who have Sabbath protocols that they're needing to follow, you know, we can help arrange for those types of things. So religious care can be very specific to someone's religious needs that are also sometimes logistical and practical needs. The spiritual care element is really for anyone and everyone. So they could use the religious pieces of our department, which we, a lot of what we do is we bring other people in for that, or they could use the spiritual parts of our department. So sometimes I will walk into a patient's room and they'll say, a chaplain, oh, I'm not religious. And I say, that's okay. Tell me what is weighing on you today. What is your, I use the term utmost concern for you today. Because usually there's something there and we really go more to the emotional if, you know, the religious element is not there for someone. And I also tell people, I'm not the church police. Like, I don't care if you've not been in a house of worship for 20 years. What I'm concerned with is, how are you doing right now in this hospitalization? What is weighing on you? And a lot of times those concerns do have a spiritual bent to them, but people may not refer to them in that way. So the largest growing population within America these days is what is usually referred to as spiritual, not religious, or in the literature, it's SNR. And so they may not even have the vocabulary for some of the things that they're looking at. But oftentimes people are telling me, you know, how fearful they are about their diagnosis or about their surgery. And usually when I ask, you know, what they're afraid of dying. And so then we do have those conversations about, you know, they ask me, well, I don't know. I'm afraid because I don't know what's on the other side. I'm afraid because I'm worried about my family. So what we're really doing is creating an environment and a holding space for people to be able to articulate the really intense aspects of what they're going through emotionally and or spiritually.
So if there are particular religious needs, then you would try to facilitate it. So if there was a Catholic who wanted a sacrament of the sick and the chaplain was a Catholic priest, then they could provide that. And if not, maybe if there was another chaplain. And if not, you might be able to call
Absolutely.
Somebody.
Yep, in. We have a priest that works with our hospital part-time from the diocese. And so we call him in for those types of situations. And that's all he does, right? And then our chaplains are doing more of that holistic care. Sometimes I'm with a patient and they might ask me to pray. And sometimes they don't, you know. And so I can do some of those things certainly in the moment as well. The other thing that we do in my hospital, which is not the case for all chaplains everywhere, but we are the department that's in charge of advanced directives. So we're having a lot of conversations with people about advanced care planning and in their relationships in their life and what they would want. And for some people, that's bringing up issues around what are my values? What brings me, meaning in my life and I would ultimately want at the end of my life? And so those can all be very spiritual conversations.
So end of life planning is something that you guys are doing separate from any other services. It's not necessarily a palliative care department or primary teams. You guys will hold these conversations and make decisions on this?
We are the ones. I mean, we're the ones helping to execute the advanced directives. But yes, we do so alongside. Palliative will often call us and say, okay, they're ready. Come on up right now for the paperwork part. So there, the conversations are happening on all sorts of levels. And hopefully there's pulse and things that are getting done as well. We're the ones that are doing the education around the advanced healthcare proxies and the living wills.
Yeah, I know a hospital I worked at once, that was how it worked. And, you know, if you had a patient who said, you know, I don't have a living will, but I think I want one. How do I do that? We just call the chaplain, and the chaplain would come up and sit down with them. And, you know, they walk them through how it works and they have the forms and the paperwork and everything. And, it was very helpful.
Yeah, I'm torn on it. I've been at hospitals where that has not been our responsibility, where it's been under social work or it's been under patient experience. But I do see the benefit to having it. My chaplains don't always love that because sometimes it is just, you know, the filling out of paperwork. Mm. But it can be helpful because sometimes I'm there with a patient and they say, and I'm asking them these questions and helping them to fill out the paperwork. And they say, oh, yeah, this reminds me, you know, of when Dad died. Like, you know, and we had to, I mean, quote unquote, we don't use this term, but a lot of our families and patients do, like, pull the plug if they had to do a terminal extubation. And then sometimes the guilt that is there or the grief that resurfaces from that. And so then we kind of just put the papers away and we listen and we walk through them, you know, with them within that moment. And then when we're ready, you know, we take that paper back out and complete that paperwork and that conversation. So we do have a little bit of the luxury to really engage in the time that it takes for some of these conversations and the other aspects of people's life that come up in conjunction with those conversations.
I feel like the non-religious aspect of what you're doing, a lot of people listening to this, to be reductive, would probably describe as therapy. I mean, that's how we would think of this kind of work, which obviously has a lot of value, but we also probably think of some other people in the hospital as providing this. So, like, how do you see your role compared to social work, for instance? Are you doing a lot of the same things? Is there overlap, or is it a different focus?
So I'm also, I am formally a social worker, although most social workers will tell you once a social worker, you're always a social worker, but I do have my MSW as well, and was in cognitive behavioral therapy before I switched over to chaplaincy. And I have close relationships with the social workers in all of the hospitals I've worked with. A lot of what they are doing in most places are more of the logistics, you know, so working with discharge planning, working to get people housed that are not housed, looking at length of stay. A lot of the care management pieces is falling to the social work. And there are times where they can do a little bit more of the listening, and that's always going to be a part of their job, but it's with a certain agenda and something that needs to happen, whereas we have a little bit more of an open agenda. As you were asking the question, I was reminded, I was one time walking behind, I think it was a fellow and a resident in the hallway, and we were passing the chapel, or some places call it the meditation space, and I heard the fellow saying to the resident, oh, and yeah, the chaplains are like the closest thing we have to counselors in the hospital, so call them, which I do think winds up being true. But again, we are there, you know, for short term, and really also encouraging people to use other resources as well. So if individuals do have, you know, their own clergy that can also be supportive of them, or, you know, using their family supports, we're always inviting them to do that as well, because we are only with them while they are hospitalized. Once they are discharged, our relationship ends.
I guess, I mean, this comes up a lot. A lot of the different services in a hospital do overlap. I mean, there is redundancy. So which of them you use for something is, it's not bad. That's good, right? Like, I could place a line, or IR could place a line. Or, like, four different surgical services can do a trach. PT and OT have a lot of overlap. But each of these people has some particular skills. Some of them may be more or less available at certain times or situations. So it's a good thing to have, you know, some different options for particular things. And it sounds like one of the real tools that the chaplain has is that they don't have much else, many other responsibilities. So they can walk in a room with really no axe to grind. I mean, they're not there for any particular purpose except to be supportive.
Yeah, and I would add to it that the other clinicians in the hospital are what I would call a spiritual care generalist. So you all, in, you know, looking at the holistic life of your patient, of assessing the family, of looking at their needs and their strengths and their resources, and caring for them, right, as a name and not just necessarily like the diagnosis or the medical record number, that is providing generalized spiritual care, you know, smiling when you're going into the room and greeting people, things that are so simple. But there's going to be times where you need to call in a specialist, right? you know, when someone is showing those signs of spiritual distress. Maybe someone got a brand new diagnosis and they're crying and asking, like, why is this happening? You know, that's a great time to call. Maybe someone is feeling helpless. We see this a lot with parents of our pediatric patients, just feeling like, I wish I could do something more. Sometimes the families are having a lot of guilt that's around that. Sometimes you have patients, I don't know if you've had these patients, that can be quite irritable and, you know, are just on the call bell all the time. No, never. On the call bell all the time. And when we go, I say sometimes that's us giving spiritual care to the staff to be able to sit with patients who otherwise are maybe needing a lot from the rest of the team. There's usually something underneath that, right? It's usually some fear or some loneliness, but it's coming out as, you know, having a lot of needs that are articulated. And so it's the same way too. If you need, you know, if you know that your patient is having heart issues, you're going to call in, you know, a cardiologist. And so I also tell staff, and again, check, your listeners should check with their local spiritual care departments in their hospital to find out how they do things. But the, I find the best model is you don't even need to ask your patients or the family if you would like a chaplain, because you wouldn't ask them, like, would you like a cardiology consult? No, you're just going to put that in. Same thing for spiritual care, because then that puts you on the spot to have to identify what a chaplain is and what we do, and it's a hard thing to know. And like I said before, ideally everyone would be getting a spiritual assessment that goes in the medical record, but we don't have enough people to make that possible. So you're helping us to be able to really see that patient. Now, patients can always say no to us, which is fine. I say, oh, you can kick us out of the hospital and or kick us out of your room, and that is fine. We are the, one of just a few disciplines in the hospital where they can do that. And to me, that's really identifying what they need in that moment and letting them know. You know, they can always follow up and change their mind if they would like.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up, because that's what, that was going to be my question, is what's the best way to go about consulting? Because I feel like I have this happen a lot, you know, where I go, oh, this is a bad scene, right? We're giving bad news, or they're struggling with this decision. And I say things like, you know, would it be helpful if I call one of the chaplains? And, you know, I live in a part of the country where a lot of people are, we'll just say religious, right? Whether or not that they're, you know, it's sort of a cultural norm here, right, in the South. And so, you know, a lot of times I get, oh, that would be great. Or, no, that's okay. We have our own pastor who we can call. But sometimes I'll get this, well, we're not really religious. And I kind of, like I said, from talking to our chaplains, know like what you've said, that, well, it, you don't have to be religious, right? And so sometimes I wonder, maybe should I have even asked, or should I have just called them? Because I then, like you said, I find myself in this, well, there, you don't have to be a religious discussion, and maybe that's not, maybe I'm not the best person to have that. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I advocate, you know, just call, and they can always say no to me. I will come and explain my role to them. And I'm, the best compliment I get from people is, when I'm starting to talk to a patient and, you know, then we have this beautiful conversation. We've been talking for 20, 30 minutes. Maybe they're crying. They're telling me things, and they say, I've never told anyone else this before. And then at the end they say, you know, when you first walked in here, I didn't think I wanted to talk to you, but now I'm really glad that I did. And so everyone, a lot of people have that suspicion of not knowing what this is. That's why I like to, you know, talk about it more, so that people have a sense of how we can help them.
Well, and so what is the interaction? I mean, is it just like cardiology, where if we want the chaplain, we put in a consult and then you're lying in wait and it pops up and you go see the patient? And if so, do you continue to see them at some point? Do you see it come back tomorrow? Or is there any proactive element to it? Like, you'll see some patients regardless of us asking for it?
Yes to all of that. It depends on the institution. And I will say this, if for the situation that you brought up before, you know, if it's, you know, giving some bad news or just had a family meeting, to the extent that you can pull in the chaplain sooner rather than later, That way we can establish a rapport and a relationship either with the patient or the family. That's always preferable. You know, sometimes we will still get calls from the ICU saying, okay, moving to comfort care now. Like, oh, okay, you know, let me run up there. But if we've known the patient over time, there's actually studies that chaplain involvement can decrease mortality rates in the ICU because we've been in those conversations earlier on and, you know, potentially help people to recognize what they're looking for. And maybe they do move to hospice and things like that. There's also some data that shows that chaplains help with minimizing readmission rates because they're having conversations and then recognizing, oh, like they don't have money to pay for their medicine. You know, let me let the rest of the team know this, or things like that that might come up that wouldn't come up otherwise. So consults are probably the best way. There are some situations where we are going to go automatically, like I mentioned, anytime that there's a trauma, anytime that there's a code, we are going to be there. Certainly for us, it's advanced directives as well. Depending on the setting, for instance, we have a pretty significant oncology service at our hospital. And so we are also baked into that protocol. Every oncology patient upon admitting is given the NCCN distress spiritual, it's the distress screening tool. So it's psychological, emotional, financial, there's probably one other on there, and spiritual. So anyone that rates them, it's a self tool. Anyone that rates themselves higher than a certain score is automatically going to get a chaplain visit. Some hospitals will do, you know, anytime that there's ECMO, they automatically get a chaplain visit, or an LVAD. So different institutions have some different policies and procedures that they put in place around that.
And is this typically a one-time visit, or will you see
Oh, yeah, I forgot
again?
That part of your question. It really varies. It depends. I mean, certainly if we're there at the end of someone's life, and it's a death visit or bereavement visit, you know, that will be a one-time visit. But if it's, you know, earlier on in the hospitalization, we are doing a spiritual assessment every time we are there to see, okay, what might this person need? So for instance, the other day, well, let me go back a few years, for a different case, you know, we have a lot of car accidents. We're a level one trauma center. So if there's a car accident and, you know, there's three people and one or two of them wind up dying in the car accident or in our trauma bay, then we're going to make sure that we are continuing to follow that patient who is, you know, hospitalized, who is in the car, especially as they're receiving the news, checking in with them daily, checking in with the family. If, you know, there's another patient who has a lot of family around, is not acutely ill, and you know, just being observed for a few days, you know, we may go in with her once and realize, no, okay, she doesn't have the same needs that someone else may have. And so it's really about what's coming up for the individual in each scenario.
Yeah, I can imagine that it would probably be of some value to, you know, see every patient every day, but like, I think we have a 500 some bed hospital. Yeah, there can't be more than one chaplain on at a time. So I imagine that's just not possible.
Yeah, we definitely don't have enough people to make that happen.
So you, I mean, you're saying certain things you go to. Like, for at our hospital, I know the chaplain comes to codes. So like, if you it's a cardiac arrest and you show up, there's this whole team going around doing CPR and yelling and stuff. What do you do? I mean, what is your process there? What do you see as your role?
So our first step is to look for the family. If family is around. And if so, we're going to attend to the family and what's going on with them. And, you know, you've probably seen their studies that, especially in the ICU, if family can witness a code, that can lead to lower PTSD and lower depression levels for that family member down the road. And the research says, only if there's a person present with them from the hospital that is kind of attending to their emotional needs. And so often we are that person, and then also liaisoning between them and the medical team. Maybe if they don't want to stay there, but they'd rather go to the family room. We always leave it up to the family and what they want and need, so long as they're not becoming an obstruction to the code situation. If there's no family present, if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, Which it sometimes is, and there's no family. If it's a double room, we're going to check on the roommate. Because as you can imagine, if there's, you know, a major event going on in the next bed, that the other patient is going to be quite disturbed and no one's, you know, able to be with him because they're having to focus all of their attention and energies on the patient who's coding. So, you know, checking with them and seeing how they're doing. If it's a single room, or there was only one time I went next door, I'll tell you the story, to the patient and his wife was there. And I was checking in on them to see how they were. And they're like, oh, they're just so loud over there. We can't even hear the TV. Like, they had no clue that they were, that, you know, the extent of what was happening. Most people are upset by it, as it's a reminder of their own mortality. And and sometimes they become friends, you know, as roommates in the hospital. And anyway. So, and then if there's no family and no roommate, we'll hang around and just see how it goes. And then if it is not successful, we're also checking in with the staff at that point to find out how they're doing with this. And sometimes they're fine and they just want to move on to the next thing. But sometimes some staff want to talk about it a little bit. And so we're there informally for that. And then we're waiting to see if and when the family is going to come. And sometimes it's in that moment, or sometimes it might be a couple hours later or the next day, we'll do a morgue visit with the family members if they weren't able to say goodbye to their loved one in that moment.
So if somebody's listening to this saying, this sounds like the sort of thing I want to be doing, I wonder if I could become a hospital chaplain. Is the first step to go and get ordained? Like they need to first, you know, pursue the religious training and then, I mean, there's no like non-religious avenue here, right? I mean, you could be a social worker or something.
There is, yes. That's becoming a larger area of humanist chaplains or atheist chaplains. And so, there's even a larger question, this might be too inside baseball, but there's a larger question within chaplaincy fields, whether or not you need the endorsement or a lot of the skills that we're learning, you know. And as you said, anyone can do there's some debate about whether you need your own kind of religious grounding or foundation. But what I would suggest is contacting your local CPE center or program, so clinical pastoral education. There's a website, acpe.org, where it lists all the different educational organizations, because sometimes, like, I have an internship program that I run, and I'll take students that are interested in chaplaincy, but they're not yet wanting to commit, you know, 3 years of higher education to some master's degree program if they're not sure. So just trying it out a little bit. I've actually had other staff people from the hospital sometimes. Like I've had a nurse, I've had a registrar, I've had someone that worked in admitting, a few different people come in and just do a unit to see, you know, how they enjoy it. So that's one option. I would also suggest Chaplaincy Innovation Lab is another organization that has a lot of great webinars that people can watch and some downloadable ebooks about, you know, all the steps that it takes to be a chaplain. You're also welcome to, I have a lot of writings that I do about chaplaincy, and I use a lot of stories in there. So I do that via Substack, which people can find on my website as well, and might want to read up a little bit more about the things in which chaplains do and see if it still piques your interest.
I think you're converting me. The more
that's not part of this.
That's not what I usually do as a chaplain. I try not to convert people. My one rule is people cannot change religions from when they come in the hospital and go out the hospital.
That's a different job you're thinking.
That's like in EMS, we used to say you have to have the same census in the ambulance when you finish the ride. No more and no fewer people. No, I mean it in critical care, at least. One of the, I think, challenges, especially in patients who have been there a while, is the dehumanizing element of it. Patients who develop this kind of persistent critical illness where now they're just kind of sick because they're sick, and it's more about recovering or not recovering than whatever the initial problem was. I think the psychological element of it is in part that they have kind of increasingly become just a medical entity, like something that we're doing stuff to, where they maybe start to forget or be convinced that they're not also a person, because every interaction and everything that happens in their day is medical. So just having experiences and interactions that are about them as a person, I think can help reground them in that. And that's why some of the things we do in like ICU liberation and things is about like getting them walking and like waking them up and maybe they can talk and things like that, which you could, it doesn't sound medical, but it can help kind of reestablish their sense of what's going on and remind them that like there's a world outside and stuff like that. So it almost really sounds like that the purity of your role, where it is just about that, just about them as a person, is where the value is, versus like you said, you know, the social worker, great, you know, they could be supportive, but they also probably are there for like a reason. So it's like the difference between you know, just venting on your bartender or something who like is just, you know, there as a friend, versus like, I don't know, like if, you know, you're a car mechanic and you know your client has cancer or something, like they may wish to be supportive, but I mean, they're at the end of the day, they're your mechanic. That's what your relation is. And I mean, even if they had the skill to support you in some other way, which they very possibly don't, that they're not really in a position to. I mean, you go and say, well, that I'm sorry about everything. Anyway, you need new oil, you know? And that's kind of how it is for me as a clinician. Like I can wish that I could have a different relationship with patients. I don't necessarily have the time or the training, but I also just, that's not the... The very fact that I have other responsibilities to them makes it difficult or impossible, I think. Whereas that's why, the only reason that you're here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to have some separation even to do your work, right? Like you have to have some compartmentalization so that you can get through all that you need to do, particularly with that patient. But yeah, I agree. There's elements of... you know, the medical pieces that also can have these lasting spiritual and emotional effects. I was just having a conversation with a physician the other day about how, you know, I love the term failure to thrive, like that diagnosis, and how failure to thrive can also have spiritual implications, right? And what do we do with that?
How can we do a better job of interfacing with our chaplains? I mean, what do you want people listening to this to know about? Not just what you do, hopefully we've discussed that, but how they can better enable you to do what you do.
Yeah, so I think, like I said, call early and often, right? So before the problem, you know, becomes a problem, yeah, really reach out to the chaplains. See about including them in rounds. You know, again, it may vary depending on the number of chaplains available in any given hospital, but oftentimes it can be multidirectional. They can hear things that will help them in their work with the patient or the family. The other way around too, they can share with you, oh, I just had this conversation, you know, with the patient's daughter the other day, and she is really nervous about, you know, this procedure that's about to get done. Maybe someone could talk to her again. So that's one way. You can also use us for yourself as well. So, you know, reach out to a chaplain. I always tell all of our staff at New Employee Orientation, you know, if you see a chaplain in the elevator, and ours wear special chaplain badges, like you have my permission to, you know, use them for your own purposes, a 5-minute vent session, you know, whatever it is that you need, that we are there to support you as well. And then just to see them as a member of the care team. You know, they are putting in notes, you know, you can read the notes. You can call, sometimes we have people that are just calling for, I mean, we also serve on the ethics team, but sometimes they're calling for, you know, a consult of, I don't know what to do because, you know, this is coming up for my patient, or, you know, had someone that was asking me, like, you know, can this Muslim patient have a, you know, a pork product in their medication and things like that. So we can do certainly some of the cultural and religious consultation, but also really involve us earlier on in care. And the family meetings as well are another place where that can be helpful to have us present. Sometimes because I don't know all the medical lingo. And so if I don't know it, I can guarantee you the family's not going to know it. And so we can sometimes help bridge that gap as well. And when you all are in there and having to have these tough conversations, at some point you're going to need to leave. We can stay and be there with them to help them kind of process what they just went on. Like our trauma team loves us for that reason, because unfortunately, if they have to be there for a notification of a death, you know, we help them to literally walk out the door and say goodbye to the family so that we can stay with the family and be with them so that they can, you know, get back to their job.
What are the
downsides to a chaplain being involved in a patient. And I'll be happy to stipulate that there are no downsides to you seeing a patient, but let's say a bad chaplain. I mean, are there pitfalls to...
Yes, yes. I mean, so that's why I recommend, you know, looking into your wherever you are and making sure that chaplains are board certified, that they've had the training, because some hospitals, I know of some hospitals that will just, you know, call up a volunteer clergy who has no background training whatsoever. Or sometimes security will call me and say, oh, this person, you know, snuck in. They were here to visit, you know, their parishioner, but now they're going room to room and, you know, we need to get them out of there. I wish that was an isolated thing, and we have very good security. So I think that the downsides are, if people are not trained, they can do damage, right? There's a lot of spiritual harm that can be done. A lot of what I rally against and teach my students on is not to use religious platitudes. We have this weird, I mean, we have toxic positivity in our society, and then we have it with a spiritual bent where people are saying things that are not helpful, like everything happens for a reason or God needed another angel. These things that are not scriptural, but they become part of our societal lexicon in a way that I really advise people to not use, because you can do harm and wounding with those words. And I do a lot of training with you know, the non-chaplain staff, which is everyone else in the hospital, because sometimes nurses and physicians and providers will say, I don't know what to do, you know, especially in the face of grief or when they're trying to, you know, be there as the patient is dying. And I tell them, you know, sometimes less is more, you know, show up and shut up. You don't need to say anything. Your presence can be enough, but words can make it worse if they're the wrong words to say. And so that can be a downside. If it's not someone who is trained, they can do some damage. And so that's why I'm passionate about the educational side of things and helping people to recognize their own stuff. A lot of our training is also about self-awareness, so that our stuff isn't getting in the way of what's going on with the patient and the family.
And I can imagine that when it comes to goals of care and decision-making, if a chaplain is sending messages explicitly or implicitly that are contrary to the conversations that have been had with the primary teams or palliative care or whoever else is involved with this, then it could be very confusing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And hopefully that is not the case. I have seen that sometimes with outside clergy, and you know, family is one way, and then they brought their clergy person in and it went a different way. There are times where it's not going to be helpful. But to me, some of that isn't necessarily even about religion or spirituality. It's also about power. It's about other elements that are going on.
What else, Brian? What should we talk about?
Well, I was just going to say, I imagine that you probably run into this, where people think your job is easy, I could do your job, right? Like you said, the people who come in and just offer like horrible spiritual advice, maybe well-meaning, but, you know, I would like to think, although I think we're in a world now where the expertise is devalued everywhere. But, you know, Brandon and I are both in positions where, you know, the average family member or friend of the family off the street is probably not going to come in and give medical advice to patients. But I can see where they very well could come in and give totally horrible, you know, spiritual advice, right? I've heard people say those things like, you know, oh, it's all part of God's plan. You know, well, is it that my kid died? Like, that sounds awful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if you follow that through, I'm going to think that God is sadistic and evil, and who would want to believe in a God like that? So,
I also wonder sometimes when I see our chaplains around, do you ever feel like isolated in your role? Because I feel like, you know, the medical team and the nurses interact quite a bit, and even some of the, you know, like respiratory therapy and stuff. But I feel like I see some of the folks who maybe aren't as enmeshed, I guess, in the team. So like physical therapy, occupational therapy, dietary, but they still kind of travel in a team. And every time I see a chaplain, I feel like it's just the chaplain by themselves. And I sometimes wonder, like, do you get lonely? Do you feel like you're not really part of the team at all? Or how do you handle like that sort of stuff?
Yeah. It has certainly varied throughout my career. Where I am now, they very much value chaplains and keep us very busy. Other places where I have worked, sometimes I've been the only chaplain in the institution. Now I have a terrific team, so I think they at least provide comfort to each other. But yeah, no one's calling the chaplain for the parties, first of all. they're calling us when something bad, you know, is going on. So that's another way you can support your chaplains. Invite them to when there's free lunch.
Yeah, I feel real bad. I really like all of our chaplains, but I probably don't call them when we have free food.
Well, and I think sometimes I'll have interns that are newer, and it's hard to get to know everyone as an intern. And when you're only there for limited hours, and they'll tell me that they can sometimes feel like a lone ranger on the floor, and it takes time to establish, you know, those relationships with the rest of the team. And so, anything that you can do to, you know, let your chaplains know that you value them. Maybe learn their names, like I said, pull them in when it makes sense from a patient perspective, but also to ask them their insights about what's going on as well.
Well, I do think when you said learn their names is a good one, right? Because like so many other people in the hospital, I'm sure people just get referred to by, hey, chaplain, or, you know, hey, whatever your title is. And I will say we have some really great chaplains who will just kind of come through the unit at times and just sit and chat with everybody and, you know, how's everything going? Anything I can help you with? Or even just like, how about you in your personal life? Anything you need, you know, doing okay? Kind of, and they're very, you know, helpful and kind without being intrusive, if that makes sense. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's the hope. That we can be approachable, and the people that want to utilize us in terms of staff can, but those that would rather not, that's okay too. Like I said, there's plenty of patients, plenty of families, plenty of staff to see.
Well, thanks for coming on. I think this has been very helpful. I feel very fortunate. I work in a place with a lot of great chaplains who do some really great work. I know that's not the case everywhere, or I shouldn't say that. Everywhere, maybe not as.
I can say that. I know. Yeah. I know that's not. Well, the case everywhere.
There are places.
We need more, more training programs, and certainly more hospitals to realize the importance of the work that we do.
Yeah, and that's what I mean, right? Not that, you know, other places have really crappy chaplains, but maybe they're just not as active or involved because there's not as many of them or whatever. And I know there's people out there who probably have very little interaction with chaplains and don't really even think about what they can bring to the team. So I think this has been very helpful to sort of educate folks. So if you're out there and you have never really thought about this before, you know, check out some of the things that Christina has mentioned. We'll link to them in the show notes, and talk to your local chaplain and see how they can help you and how you can help them. So thanks for coming on. And, just a reminder, everybody, that everything that's said here is just our thoughts and opinions. We don't represent any of our respective institutions in any kind of formal or official way. And we hope that this has been helpful, and we'll see you next time.